draw your attention to the stuff in your seats, in case you didn't notice when you sat on. If you got some goodies there, please look over them. One is about the options in education. Well, a couple of different forums. Eventually, we go to about options in education. And one is a feedback form about tonight. So at the end, we'd love for you to take from the one or two to fill that out. We'd love to hear your thoughts on what you thought about the evening. We'll take, I'm Lauren Cunningham, by the way. I'm the HOPE Coalition, which is, stands for Having Options in Public Education. And I'm also a parent in the Madison School District. We'll have time tonight for a discussion between our panelists here, distinguished panelists. That'll be about half the time, then hold your questions, and then the second half of the time, we'll get to your, just some Q&A time, and I'll make some attempt at kind of moderating that, make sure things kind of keep moving along, and stay focused on this topic of school options and models and so on. To introduce who our distinguished panelists are, perhaps the lesser known would be at the end of the table, Rafael Gomez, who's a counselor at both Senate and Cherokee Middle Schools. He's long been had a passion for youth and education, even back to his days as a city planner many years ago in Texas, but then decided to make the career change to become a school counselor and make his way up to Wisconsin. And he is not here representing either of his schools or representing the district or in any other position, just for himself. He's been a part of a lot of different task forces and committees in the district, so he's a long history of involvement. He's also an educational consultant and is at the roots of developing an Institute of Pedagogical Dialogues. So this topic is especially here. And our other distinguished panelist, I think most of you know, is our superintendent, Mark Rainwater, who is retiring this year, and there has been and will continue to be much more discussion of his many accomplishments in his tenure here. And most recently, I'll add, noted in a letter to the editor in the State Journal, I believe it was yesterday, from the dean of the School of Education at UW-Madison, raising his accomplishments and that of the district in general and the board in raising the overall graduation rates in the district during his time here, and especially for African American students. So I thought that was a great thing to note. We certainly do appreciate his time, your time being here. It is not any obligation on your part. We appreciate all of this extra effort you want to giving your time to us. And we certainly appreciate his efforts, and hopefully, even after you retire, we'll enjoy the benefit and something you have to offer as well. Okay. This discussion is going to be based on, I'll stop talking hopefully shortly, will be based on the presentation he made to the board, the Performance and Achievement Committee, in particular back in October, when you talked about different school models. So, for those of you that weren't able to be there for that or didn't see it online, I will give the very condensed version of that, just so you have some idea of what this is, what we're going from here. He first talked about neighborhood schools versus choice schools, okay, very broadly. Neighborhood schools, that's what we're used to for the most part, what we think of when we think about the attendance area that you live in. Then four different kinds of choice schools, one being a charter school. This district has two, the Western Middle and Wright Middle School. Second would be a magnet school. And third would be a specialty school. And fourth would be an alternative school or or alternative program. There's a little bit different flavor to each one of them. With the charter, there's a separate governing body that a separate organization that enters into a charter with the state, and that's how the school is run. Charters are becoming more and more popular in the state and in the country. They're usually started to, for any number of different reasons, to serve a specific population, to provide certain educational opportunities for students or teachers, provide kind of a laboratory for developing innovative educational approaches. There can be any number of reasons why any organization might want to plan and run a charter school. In the case of a magnet school usually has a, can be done to have a special approach to education. And it's usually done to, it is by definition, a magnet school is designed to reduce any element of segregation that's naturally occurring within a school district. A specialty school, like Spring Harbor that we have, has a content specialization, which is environmental education. And that is similar to a magnet school, but without this desegregation element. And then alternative schools are usually designed for, or programs, not schools, but programs as well, designed for students that are having not successful in a traditional school setting. So in our case, Shabazz would be an alternative school, but there are other alternative programs in our district. The Work and Learn program and the Diploma of Completion program. So sometimes the goal for participating in one of those schools or programs is for a student to re-enter the traditional neighborhood school, but sometimes not. Okay, that's a general description of them. If you have questions about any of that, you can probably save it for later. For now, I will turn it over to Michael. Thanks to all of you for giving up your evening.
Thank you. Thank you for coming.
Sure.
One of the things that I really enjoy working with the Mass School District is you and Chase.
No, here.
No.
There's a voice a little bit more. Thank you.
You can tell.
Thank you. It's your leadership and your passion for education. And I share that with you. I really have a passion for education. And one of the things that we have pointed out here is there a difference between a model school and a school assignment, or is this the same words that you need to say?
Well, I think they're parts of the same process. For example, right now we're in the process of doing a high school redesign. And in my mind, high school design is the actual creation of what a school is going to look like. It's the process itself. The model is basically what you create at the end of that. It's an outcome. Technically, I guess you create a model when it's adopted by more than one person. And I might distinguish those of you that aren't familiar with education jargon, that we use the term an education model in a very different way than, for example, we would use model in architecture, where an architect designs a building and then creates a small-scale, three-dimensional piece of that, and that's a model in architecture. For us, a model describes a type of school or a type of program and all the things that make that program unique to itself. The Nuestro Mundo being an example. Nuestro Mundo is a dual immersion magnet school, Spanish and English. And there are certain things that are inherent in dual language immersion. And so when you adopt, so there's a model of dual language immersion that says that you have two languages, the language is taught, both languages are taught to all children. The children are native speakers, half of them are native speakers in one language and half are native speakers in the other language. And they are taught simultaneously together so that both become bilingual again. The criteria that I just described the model of dual language immersion. So to me, that's the difference, is the design is the actual process of creating that criteria and the components of what the school will be, where the model is the actual product itself.
So what I'm hearing from you is the sign is kind of setting up the structure of the model. And the model comes as some criteria to look for. And that gives me a system of control within a system. Am I hearing that correctly?
That's right. Well, I mean, in education, and everything else, I mean, if you're building a Chevrolet Malibu, I mean, there are certain design criteria, and there are tolerances, and there are the way not only the way it looks, but the kind of engine it has, and all those kind of things were designed by somebody. The process was made to bring that together, but when you look at it and you see the shape of it and you look at the engine, then that's a Chevrolet Malibu as compared to a Saab, for example. So you can kind of think of it the same way. It's most prevalent if you look at what doesn't exist as much anymore today, but back in the day when you had some fairly large magnet school systems where there were some very identifiable and very clear models of education involved. The one that I was involved most in was Kansas City, where, for example, we had a high school that was science and math, and that's what they concentrated on at that high school. And they had specialized teachers, and they had all those kind of things. And we had a high school that was performing arts. And they had specialized violin teachers and those kind of things. And so what the components were of those two defined the model, but they were very distinguished from each other. Well, it's kind of the same thing, that kind of thing.
And prior to getting to that component of the math school, they had to do a design.
Right.
So they go together, complement one another. So the thing is to be careful once we talk about the model, what are the criteria that makes the model?
That's right.
That's where the question arises. Now, in the medicine school district, one of the things that is uniforming through the whole district is the elements. There are three elements: the elements of relationship, the element of learning, the element of engagement. There could be a thousands interpretations of that. Could you kind of let us know what each one is?
Sure, I can give you a little bit of history of where it came from. In trying to look at, I'm a person who believes very much in creating frameworks that allow you to focus and stay focused on what you're doing. And so back in probably the year 2000, 2001, we had a group of our teachers who went to Naperville, Illinois to a conference, and they came back and met with me, and they said, you know, the person giving the conference asked this question. When a kid isn't being successful, what do you do? What does your school district do? And so they asked me the question, what do we do? And I said, the obvious thing, we do a lot of things. You know, we do like 500 things. And in talking about that, I realized that we probably did 500 things. None of them were tied together, and none of them made a lot of sense. They might be very good for three kids over here and four kids over there, but as was typical, particularly in the early days of our school district, just because somebody was doing it at Sennett Middle School and it was working really well at Sennett Middle School didn't mean that they were doing it at Hamilton Middle School. They were inventing their own thing. One of the great joys of the Madison School District is one of the things I think that is unique to us is we always believe that if we didn't invent it, it can't possibly be any good because we would have thought of it first. Trying to move past that culture has been a challenge to say the least. But out of that grew what we now call the educational framework, which is the three key components to. At the same time that question was being asked and we were beginning to think about what kind of system to put in place so that we could focus everything we were doing and be sure that everything tied together, I'm a person who believes very, very strongly in systems. That's really kind of who I am. And And I learned, obviously, has become clear, I guess, from my biography that's been around a little bit. I've been doing this a long, long time. This is my 43rd year, and over that time, I've made a lot of mistakes and learned a few things. But today, in today's world, when we're trying to educate children, it is an extremely complex task. And it takes very complex solutions. This idea that there are simple solutions to very complex tasks may apply someplace, but it certainly doesn't apply in education. And so I'm a person who is always trying to find and create the relationships between all the things that we do. So as we were talking about this and thinking about it, at about that same time, there was a major educational study done by a professor at Harvard named Ron Ferguson. And actually, we were part of the Minority Student Achievement Network that we were part of. I don't know if you know, some of you probably aren't familiar with the organization, but the Minority Student Achievement Network is a group of now 25 schools, originally 15 school districts, that are very similar to us. It's us, Chapel Hill, North Carolina, Ann Arbor, Michigan, Cambridge, Massachusetts, Evanston, Illinois, originally Berkeley, California, Green Bay, Wisconsin is now in. It's a group of school districts like us. We jointly funded and participated in the study by Ron Ferguson about how children look at school and react to school, and from that tried to draw conclusions about what was important about what we do. What really came out of that study that guided our work on the framework and really was the impetus for it was that when you looked at, and it was a very large, very well-structured survey that was given to students in grades 7 through 11. 41,000 students took the survey across the United States. And what resulted from that was some really kind of fundamental changes in beliefs about children, particularly African-American and Latino kids. If you looked at this survey, children, regardless of race or regardless of income, really looked at school about the same way. About 95% of the items that they tested looked at school basically the same way. The belief that we had that there were kids who came to school that weren't interested in doing well really just weren't borne out. They may not be doing well. But what really was a defining difference was that 5% that was due. And when you looked at what that was, it really revolved around the relationships that the adults in the school, and very specifically the teacher of the child, the relationship that they had with the child. That's where differences really came to the fore. And I'll give you an example of kind of the guiding things that we've looked at. One of the findings was that, interestingly enough, almost all the kids surveyed spent about the same amount of time working on schoolwork outside of school, with the exception of Asian girls who, like, don't go to bed. I mean, it was incredible. I mean, everybody else spends like an hour and a half. Asian girls spend like 5 hours. I mean, it was literally that started. But everybody else spends about the same amount of time. But the survey also showed that African-American kids, for example, only complete that work about half the time. And when you look at the results of that in terms of why they say that's true, reading is an issue, and not understanding what the teacher wants is an issue. But the bottom line is they work the same amount of time, and they're completing the work about half as much. So that's one factor. A second factor was what encourages that child to do well. I mean, what is it that motivates a child to do well? And that was a major difference. Understanding this is an aggregation of everybody's thoughts. White children, black children, everybody else goes across the scale, obviously. For white children, the predominant factor was a demand. In other words, somebody demanding that I do it. For African-American children, the predominant factor that was motivating to them was encouragement. And encouragement was important to white children also, but it was overwhelmingly important to African American children. And demand isn't even on the scale. And the third thing that we looked at and trying to put everything together was the findings around what makes you admire somebody. And you're talking about your peers now, not adults and national figures like this. Your peers. What about your peers do you admire? And for white children, it was leadership, it was those kind of typical things. And it was that too for African American children, but it also was toughness. And toughness was a major factor. So let me put that together for you in a scenario to think about what happens in a school. Here's a child who worked on their homework last night and didn't get it done. And so they're going to come to school the next day, and they've got a choice. You hand in the half-done homework, or you don't hand it in at all. Now, as a teacher, and this would be me, don't misunderstand me, this is exactly how I would handle it in my teaching days. This didn't just happen today. This also happened yesterday and the day before. So what I say is, you didn't get your homework again. You're lazy, you're not, you've got to work hard to do this homework. So, F for you today. And I might have done that in front of the class. Now, when you think about a child and the relationship they have with their peers and their place with their peers, a child for whom toughness is an important component of their personality, if they want to be liked and respected by their peers, how do they react to that? They get tough. And a teacher reacts to that, and pretty soon I have a child in the office. Think about very quickly what would have happened in that exact same situation if the presumption had been the child wanted to do what was right, and for whatever reason couldn't. And what the teacher had said to the child when they didn't have their homework was, you can do this. Let's sit down at lunch and figure out why you're not doing it, and I'll provide help. Or, Johnny is really good at this. Let me get the two of you together, and y'all sit down and see if we can get you through this. Because you can do this work. It's always been one of the, and you're probably going to hear some of my beliefs tonight, but one of my beliefs has always been one of the worst things we do with children is we give them a test, we mark an F, and we give it back. That says a lot of things to a kid. Instead of saying, okay, here's the things you did wrong, let's try to learn from that. So we looked at that and thought about the two things I just described to you, the two ways of handling that. And it becomes very clear that the relationship between the teacher and the child, particularly our children who aren't being successful, is a key component. We've always known that engagement, having the child engaged in the school, and whether that's engaged in activities or engaged in the classroom, but where they are part of and engaged with the school is important.
Am I hearing in relationships, in the word relationship, it has four components. Components of, so maybe that's not the word to use, but it has compassion, respect, he has encouragement, and he has recognition.
I would say that's true. I think if you think about relationships, some of the things that we've tried to say is that, I mean, first of all, you need to believe, if you're an adult working with children, you've got to believe they want to succeed. I mean, that's thing number one. You've got to believe that they want to succeed. And second of all, you've got to believe that if they're not, you can make a difference. That you have the ability to change them. And that sounds like a really simple thing. But everybody doesn't believe that. And sometimes, if you're teaching day in and day out, particularly with a child who's not being successful, it's very easy to get to doubting yourself. And either you doubt yourself or you turn off the kid. But that's the third thing is that every day has to be a new day. to me, that's one of the keys to relationships between adults in school and kids in school. We all learn that as parents with our own children. Let me tell you, because for the kid, it's a new day, believe it. Yesterday doesn't even exist. I woke up, it's a new day today, I'm starting over, here we come. We have to be willing to let kids do that. What I've said often is that there needs to be an adult in the classroom. We would prefer it to be. That works a lot better. So those are the kind of key important things that we talk about around relationships. But certainly compassion, respect. We spend an awful lot of time as a school district working on race relations, for example. Really with the whole goal of beginning to understand that what the child is telling you and showing you from their culture is their truth. And their truth is okay. It may not be your truth. We'll have that. As you listen to me tonight, I'm sure there'll be things that I will say that are very detailed beliefs to me that you completely disagree with. Okay? But that's my truth. Okay, that's who I am. That's what I believe. Just as you have beliefs, and that's your truth. Well, that's the same thing in the relationship between teachers and kids. Particularly when kids come from different cultures than you do. And their whole norms when they go home are very, very different than the culture they're given to you. So
in the word of relationship, brings the student and the teacher together with mutual respect, with compassion, with exploring their understanding. And part of that is, you talk about engagement. We always believe to get the youngsters involved, to get it to motivate them to art, music, dance, mechanics, to get them involved. Where does the learning come from? What do we do?
First of all, we've always recognized, or certainly for the last 15, 20 years, we've recognized that having a positive classroom is important. And that's kind of what we call it. And we've always recognized that kids need to be engaged. If one of them is learning to occur. But you have to kind of think about it the way we thought about it up until the framework, which was that's really a pyramid. The most important thing is learning. And by learning here, we're talking about not only the outcomes of the child, but the actual pedagogy, the actual teaching strategies that the teacher used in the classroom. That was the most important thing. And along the way, we should try to get this positive climate in the classroom. And we should try to engage the kid by teaching things they're interested in. Okay. But if you think about it, learning was up here, and these other two things were kind of subsidiary to that. What the educational framework did was said, no, those three things are equal. It is just as important, if not more important, how you relate individually, one-to-one, to the children in the classroom as the teaching strategy that you use. Creating that positive climate isn't creating the positive climate in the classroom. It's creating that encouraging and supportive relationship with each individual and single child. And that's just as important as whatever teaching strategy you use, whether that's cooperative learning or whatever it is. That was the key piece of the framework. Along with the fact that when children aren't learning, we need to have structured and planned interventions that are related to that specific type of learning that isn't occurring. And thirdly, the third part of the framework that is important is that we want to create a collaborative environment in our school among the adults. Teaching has historically been a very, very solitary profession. I go in my classroom, I close the door, and I teach my kids. And if things are going wrong, our culture is to not ask for help. Because if I ask my peers for help, they think I'm not very good. And if I ask the principal for help, Lord help me, that'll be a black mark, and I'm going to be in trouble. So the truth was, we could have a teacher who was struggling greatly with an individual kid. A teacher right down the hall who has that kid in another setting who's doing extraordinarily well because they found the key to relating with that child, and the two of them never shared. So the goal, and we're certainly not there yet, because let me tell you, changing culture is not the quickest thing in the world that you do. So trying to change that culture from one of being very solitary and very isolated doing my own thing to one in which we have collaborative teams of adults around every single child, and just as importantly, collaborative teams of adults around each other in their practice is something we've been working on for a long time. We may be halfway there, but that's an important part of what we're trying to do.
So is it possible to say, when we're looking at learning, we're looking at a process of reflection?
No, I think when we're looking at learning, we're looking at the acquisition of knowledge and skills. That's what we're looking at. That's what learning is. Learning is the acquisition of knowledge and skills.
Is it possible? I'm learning from you. Is it possible to learn to have skills and knowledge without reflection?
Well, I think reflection is one of the things that, let me back up. Is it possible to learn rote knowledge? In other words, you ask me a question and I didn't memorize the answer and I can give you that answer back. Is it possible to do that without reflection? Yes. Is it possible to learn the sheer skill of taking a screwdriver and screwing it through? Yes, it is without reflection. Absolutely. But to learn the things that we need to learn so that we're creating students, because that type of rote knowledge is no longer applicable in most workplaces. That's not enough. But to be able to learn to work with other people, to be able to work collaboratively, to learn to problem solve, to learn to recognize a problem when you see one, which is the first key to problem solving that everybody misses, to know you've got a problem, to do the problem solving that's involved with that, I believe you're right. I think that does take reflection. And most importantly, and where I deviate from the true back to the basics people is it also takes learning and practice to do that.
So I'm hearing that you agree. We need to have some reflection in the process of learning.
Absolutely.
And that's right.
We need to do that as adults too.
That's right now it's happening. It's happening right now. I'm learning the side of reflection, what you say. And we're putting all these pieces together, making sense in terms of what. Now,
I'm just tell you what I do.
Yeah.
As a superintendent, every day is literally a new day. I mean, it really is. I mean, every day there's something that happens that just astounds me. I'll tell you a little story. The other day, as you know, we don't let out school very often for snow, which means that every time it snows, I get a lot of very irate calls. And a lot of them are from students. But I got an email the day after this last big snow. I got an email from a student at one of our high schools. And after he got through telling me how glad he was I was retiring and how they hated my guts, after he got through with that, he said that I had almost killed his dog. The reason I'd almost killed his dog was because when he had to go to school, because I didn't call school often, and managed to put that in the sentence, because I didn't call school and he had to go to school, his dog got out. When he went out the door to get on the bus because I didn't cancel school, his dog got out and he didn't have time to go chase his dog down because he had to get on the bus. And when he got home that night, his dog was under the porch and almost frozen to death. And it was totally my fault. Now, why it wasn't his fault that he let the dog out, I have no idea. But that was amusing to me. But every day as a person, and I think this is what we want to teach children with. When my day is over, I sit down every day, and I have for 43 years, I sit down every single day, and I reflect on that day. What did I do well today? What do I wish I'd have done differently today? What did I learn today? How's that going to apply tomorrow? I do that every single day. So I think that's one of the things that distinguishes us as human beings from others, is our ability to do that. And I think that's an important thing for children to learn. is that you reflect on what happened. You plan everything and then you reflect on what happened.
And that brings us to the another question here. We have youngsters who are doing their own reflection and they take every day at a time. Youngsters from all walks of life. And we have youngsters who have come to a building, they receive their warm feelings, they feel a sense of belonging, a sense of recognition. But now they reach the fifth grade, now they move to the sixth grade. Is there a transition bridge for them so it can help them to adjust? Or do we need to think about one?
Well, certainly. Obviously the two big transitions that occur are from elementary school to middle school, to middle school to high school. There's transition every year. And I think because the child is in that same building, people know one of those things are easy, but you're transitioning every year. I can remember years ago, I believe it was Muir Elementary School, had it's before we had full-day kindergarten. And but the path had kindergarten in most of our schools at that time. Muir had raised money, and the parents provided the rest of the day in kindergarten. And this went on 1 or 2 years, and then there was a year they didn't raise the money, and we ended up having to foot the bill. And so the board voted to not have that happen anymore. And so Muir had lost their full-day kindergarten. And I can remember the parent who came to the board and said that because their child was not going to be able to bond with their kindergarten teacher because they were only going to be there half a day, basically their life was over. And the single most important thing in a child's life was bonding with their kindergarten teacher. I didn't have kindergarten, I don't know about you, which is why I'm so screwed up bonding with that kindergarten teacher, I'd be better off. But I'm using that to illustrate that that's the beginning, and there's these continual transitions that go on. That if you have little kids right now, you see it every day. How about the transition of friends? Kids have different friends like Dave, and all the old friends hate them, and they hate the old friends. Middle school, you've been there yet. But the big transitions where things really change. The first one is obviously from elementary school to middle school. And in our district, that's much more about a difference in educational philosophy than it is science. Because our middle schools typically are about the same size as our elementary school. And in our case, it's really about now I have more than one teacher. Now I'm changing classes. The expectations are a little bit different. But the really big jump is not between 5th and 6th grade. The really big jump is 8th to 9th grade. Because now everything is different. First of all, I go from a middle school, in many of our cases, most of our cases, are 400 to 450 kids. With kids that I went to elementary school with, I go now to a 2,000 student high school. Where it takes me for a semester to be able to find where all my classes are. And the philosophy of education has totally changed. The responsibility, there's nobody really looking out for me anymore. Well, the whole purpose is to look at high school redesign. It shouldn't be like that. So those transitions are critical. We have tried to address those. And I think one of the best things we've done is we've had kids in the last couple of years that have gone from the 8th to the 9th grade. The first day of school now is just 9th graders in the high school. And that's had a really, I think, positive impact in terms of at least the child getting into the building and being able to know their teachers and find people around and do those kind of things has been big. But there's a lot of other things we can do. But there are kids that get lost in that transition. Now, to be very honest, there are generally kids who are already struggling in the middle school. They may not even be struggling to the point that we have picked it up. But toward the end of that middle school, they're beginning to struggle. They're maybe beginning to struggle academically, they're maybe having problems, or maybe some other kind of thing. And then that move into the high school is just one step too far. So you try to manage those. You obviously can't do everything about it because it's going to happen. And as children are getting older, it's not the biggest transition they'll make. The biggest transition they'll make is the next one. Whether that's going into the world of work or going out into going to college. Particularly the transition. At the point in time that a student, young adult, transitions actually out into the world is probably the biggest transition that they make. And our ability to help prepare them to do that is critically important. And it's interesting to me that for our special education children, there is a transition plan that we are required to do that's very detailed about how that child and how we're going to support that child in transitioning out into the world. For everybody else, you know, transition is we help you do a career plan. But that's still a big transition. I can barely remember what was the transition. And it is for all of our kids. That day that you are on your own, truly on your own, there's no safety net. You know, you're out there, you've got a job, you've got to perform on that job. You've learned you may not like that job, but you need the money, or you've learned you don't like your boss. All those kind of things is the biggest transition. I don't think, overall do a great job of preparing kids for that. And I don't know that I did a great job as a parent.
All right, what I'm hearing here, you bring us to a reality. There's continuous change in our society. And we're part of the change. As an adults and doctors, we're continuous change. But you did point it out, this here in Madison, that your experience, that one of the biggest transitions is going from 8th grade to the 9th grade. As part of that, there has been some initiatives like having one day only for the 9th graders. I also hear from you how, and I don't know if I'm hearing this correctly, that we still need to do more work in enhancing the autonomy of the youngster, their own self-identity, their own selfhood. We need to do still more work on that.
One of the major factors about working with children who truly live in poverty, particularly children who live in neighborhoods in which everybody lives in poverty, is the absolute lack of hope. And it's one of the things that we as a school district, and I think that we as a community have to be very conscious of trying to enhance. Operation Fresh Start, for example, does a great job, I think, of taking children who have dropped out of school, young adults who have dropped out of school, and through working with them and working with them actually on the job, being successful at doing something and providing them that support, gives them hope that they can be something. Because and I spent a number of years working truly in the inner city of Kansas City, where the school district itself at that time was a little bit over 80% low income, and with very, very large areas of very low income populations in the city. When you see children who really see no hope beyond 21. And so our ability as a community and as an educational institution to truly show children that there is hope, that there are things that you can do to be successful and help them find what those things are. It's one of the key reasons why we have been so strongly focused on reading in the primary grades. Because that is really and truly the key to everything else. And I think it's not about, and this goes to the issue of hope, it's not so much about the fact that kids can't read, the actual act of reading. Because we can teach adults to read. Interestingly enough, we can do a pretty good job of teaching adults to read. But if a child goes to school every single day for 4 years, and the focus of everybody is on reading, I mean, that's what primary school is all about. We talk about math, and we talk about some other things, but it's really about reading. Okay? And I go to school every single day, and all the other kids can read. And I can't read. What that does to a child's, the word we've used over and over, self-esteem, belief in themselves, having hope for their future. Because no matter how many smiley faces you give them, and no matter how many times you pat them on the back, believe me, kids are smart. They know. All these kids can read, and I can't read. And I need to be read. It's that 4 years of failure that make that third grade really so critical. So that's why we focus so much there, because of the impact it has later on. And the lack of hope that a child has, the longer they stay in school, and the longer they're unsuccessful. That's the major issue that we face. And we see that our children, generality, our low-income children, particularly our low-income minority children, when they enter the school district, that achievement gap exists the day they walk in the door. And so the question is, how can we reduce that?
Arne, you think it's a very complex issue in terms of education.
Well, it is a complex issue.
Isolation, hope, and the complex of education. Coming back to the school design, the school model, the framework, relationship, is it helping us to nourish the hope?
Sure. Yeah, and whatever you can do that engages the child in the institution of school, I think is important. One of the things we learned in Kansas City, which was the largest magnet school program ever attended, one of the things we learned that when children are allowed to select, and this particularly comes true in high school, if the student is allowed to select the magnet thing, not the parent, the student is allowed to say, you know, I really like that agribusiness high school. When the student is allowed to select the emphasis, it's highly successful. When the student wants to do one thing and the parent wants to do something else, and the parent wins, then we're right back where we started. Because I can recall this conversation well. You're not going to be able to go to MIT if you go to agribusiness school. You need to go to science class school. But I don't care about science and math. Why would I want to go there? Because I told you, because I'm your dad. That's why you're doing it. Okay. This is the kid that we're going to be picking up later. So, is that one tool that is important? It is. What I think you have to balance it with, though, is whether or not by creating choice, if you don't provide opportunities for all kids to have all of those choices, you're going to create a difficult situation. And so one of the things, and this is one of the things that was obvious in Kansas City, was that just the sheer cost of doing that is such that it's almost unaffordable. Because if you have a large low-income population, particularly, or you have a large working class population where both parents are working, it is very, very difficult for a child who wants to do agribusiness, which is located in the east, and my home is on Allied Drive, it is impossible for me to get there. So it truly isn't a choice for them. And so what ends up happening in those kind of situations, and what, at least in my belief about public education, what makes it difficult is that I have now created haves and have-nots in my school district, and I have lost what I think is a great strength of ours, which is our diversity. And so whenever you create systems of choice, You have to provide opportunities for everyone to have their choices. And that's what makes it difficult in the current, not just the math, I'm just talking about revenue caps, I'm talking about school funding in general in the United States. In Kansas City, we spent, we were 35,000 students, so 10,000 students better than this. Every child had the choice every semester to go to any school they wanted to. $50 million a year in transportation. 1991. Gas was what? 75 cents a gallon? 50 cents a gallon? Today, that'd be what? 150 million a month? But that's what it takes. If you truly are going to maintain what I believe, public, you got to understand that my beliefs about all this comes out of my own personal beliefs about public education and what it is and why it's important.
So, can I stop for that?
Sure.
Do you want to have a chance to kind of reflect on what he's saying, and then we'll open it up to questions?
Well, I will just say what I'm hearing. Okay. And what I'm hearing is sharing with us the beliefs about education. And what he hears me saying is that we need to find ways to get a youngster interest. And find ways that the youngster interest is there in the education. That's, we're talking high school. The other part that you're saying is we have to be very careful, because sometimes when we create those choices in one building, may require the youngster to travel from one side of town all the way to the other side of town. And they may not have the transportation or the adult support to do that. So this is a serious problem that we probably have here in Madison, and you're making us aware of that.
All right. We'll open it to the floor.
Anybody
have any questions?
Getting back to the first study when you were talking about relationships, you talk about demand versus encouragement and tough, the requirement to be tough in certain contexts. The question I have is why? Well, what's actually going on in those children's lives where toughness and I expect that encouragement is required for the kids who are involved in demand too. But what is actually going on seems to be symptomatic rather than the cause and effect issues. It seems to be symptomatic of something else that they're up for treatment. And what is going on there?
Well, first of all, again, let me go back to something else I said. That is that I have to, if I'm going to educate this child, I'm going to meet this child, I have to understand that I may not agree with that as what's a motivating factor for who I like. I may not agree with that. I may think there's something negative that's caused that, but that's irrelevant. What's relevant is that child's truth. And I have to accept that it's their truth. And I have to be able to work with that. On the issue of encouragement, I believe encouragement is important for everybody. I mean, I don't necessarily believe that demand is a good way to go about doing it. I think encouragement and support are in fact good ways to teach every child. I think that's important in terms of building that relationship. But whether or not the issues the child brings to the table are cultural or are symptomatic of societal issues or societal problems, that can't be my issue. My issue has to be that is in fact who that child is. And I have to adapt my teaching and my relationship to understanding that and helping that child get the hope they need and the skills, the knowledge they need to be a successful adult. That's what it's about. And so that's the way I've looked at it. It goes to the same thing about there's no question if a child has parent support, and I don't mean going to the PTO, okay? I mean the child goes home, the parent's interested in what they're doing, the child's encouraging them, the parent's saying, what do you got for homework tonight, what happened in school today, even if the answer you get is nothing, which it normally is, that's parent support, okay? And if the child has that, they have a much better chance of being successful in school. There's tons of research out there. Well, the bottom line is, so what? I've got a whole bunch of kids who don't have that. As an educational institution, we can't say, well, God, your parents should have did something, it'd be okay. No, we can't do that. We've got to find a way to compensate for that not being there. Well, it's the same way we've got to help children move toward the time. Part of the skills they're acquiring is the skills to work in the society they're going to be in. Part of the skills they acquire is the kind of things I got to be able to do to keep a job. You know, I got to be there on time. No matter how much I hate the boss, you know, if they say, I need you to do this, you don't say, eh. You know, I mean, some of those little things like that that you have to learn that aren't necessarily maybe for all of our kids. So, long answer to the question.
There are bosses that can learn to but there are also some children who have moved and camps have been arranged for them around their whole rural camps. And they take kids over that got important, and I think that's wonderful. But I'm wondering if it's good to look at, okay, where is the one going, where would it be feasible? Do you have a school that's, you know, one side of town and be able to get kids from all the neighborhoods over there?
Well, I think if you're looking at, I mean, first of all, the children that you're talking about are homeless children, okay, who we are required by law to provide their transportation. And,
well, maybe they could be incorporated in the process.
But it's a very minimal amount of money when you look at the overall cost. We have enough examples of magnet school systems in our country. To know, because you're not talking about one school that you got a group of kids being busted. You're talking about opening up not any option. You're talking about having a school district in which parents have options. You're talking about options, not an option. And we have pretty good documentation now of what kind of transportation system it takes to make that happen. We haven't done one here, but there certainly are those systems that have existed. And existed is more nearly the term now that exists, but that it existed under federal court order, that we know kind of what that has to look like. And I mean, there's always a question, if you believe as I do that good teaching can engage children in typical schools, that it doesn't in fact take that. If you're using what we know about best practice today in today's world, and if you're really and truly tying your teaching back to the kids' experiences, if you're doing those kind of things that we know about in today's world, that you can engage children in typical school. I'm not saying that I believe choices are better, because ultimately, regardless of what happens, regardless of what you call the school, and regardless of what emphasis you give to the school, the end of all that is the teacher and the kid. And so, does it maybe help if you get the right kids who got to pick the right school in the right place that the emphasis is on something they're interested in? Yeah. But does it overshadow the cost, and can we gain the same thing with the right kind of teaching in a regular school? I believe that 110% we can. As I said, I've designed the largest magnet school program in history. So I've got some experience with it. I don't believe we gained anything more than we could with very, very good teaching. With what we know about teaching, we've got to do that.
Sarah, I have just a comment really quick and then a question. My comment is, you mentioned on your experience with choice systems is that you have to do a lot of options or no options in order to not create the haves and have-nots. And my comment on that is that in my experience, wealthy folks have to send their children to a private school. So, in effect, we already have a have-not system, and so why not open up more options for those people that are the have-nots, at least give them something. And that's just a comment. I don't need any response on that.
No, I'll respond to that because I think it's an important idea. It's about who funds the choice. I believe very strongly in private schools. I'm not an opponent of private schools. If someone wants to pay tuition and that money is funded outside the public funding, I've spent 20 years in Catholic schools. I have absolutely no problem with private schools, if that's what they are. Where I have a problem is with public funding. for private schools. That's where I have a problem, because I have a very, very strong belief in the fundamental need for true public education if we are going to, in fact, continue to remain free. We have to educate all children, not only to be in the workforce, but more important, we have to educate all children to be consumers of the polity. That is the key component of public education. You have to go back and look at what our founding fathers said about public education. Because it would, even though it's not in the Constitution, Jefferson and Adams, for sure, addressed it very, very clearly about how important it was to have an educated populace to remain free. And so my beliefs about public education are based on that. Would it be great if everybody knew it? Yeah. But what we've got to be sure of is that everybody has the very best education that the public can provide. And I believe very, very strongly that public funding, that public education should be controlled by locally elected schools. And believe me, I have had schools over many years as head of every superintendent in the world. But I really and truly believe that is critical our way of life and our government. And so that's why I so strongly believe that we need a public arena funded by public tax dollars and purporting to, in fact, create that educated populace that we can't create haves and have-nots within that environment. That's why. And your question?
And then my question was, you talked a lot about, or the question was related a lot to relationship engagement and learning framework. And my question was, what are certain schools in Madison, teachers, just examples of things going on in Madison that are within that framework? Because you also talked about teachers not talking to each other, with one being successful with a kid and one teacher not. Kids going through the transition from middle school into a 2000 student high school. So what are some things going on in Madison that, you know, that suggests that we are actually thinking about the relationships
engaged? Our elementary schools today, before we started with implementing collaboration, our elementary schools today are almost totally teamed. With our instructional design, there are now very, very few, if any, situations in which there aren't collaborative teams working around kids and with each other. I would guess we're probably halfway there with the middle schools in making progress. We're less there with the high schools. One of the things that anytime I'm with a group of superintendents from around the country and we're talking about change, the first thing that comes up is have you ever changed a high school? High schools are extraordinarily difficult to change. And we've been trying since the 60s. But at the high schools, we have some very strong but isolated examples. For example, mathematics at each high school is, in my mind, doing everything. Plus, they're generating a lot of success. But they truly are, as a department, a team approach to what they're doing. Biology at West High School is another example. So there are isolated places across the district in the high schools where that's occurring. And what you're trying to do is then you build on those places. When those teams show success, you build on those places. But changing culture is a long-term project. I mean, when I retire, I was a superintendent a little bit over 10 years. And if I changed the culture that far in here, just taking, we're 170 years old, so you can imagine a lot of history. I always try to mention that we're older than the state, older than the city. Our younger siblings are back then. So, that's
interesting. I have a couple of questions. I'll try to tie them into what you were talking about just now.
Oh, don't.
Well, in talking about programs being equally available to everyone, how do you feel about the programs currently in existence here in the school district that aren't open to everybody? Or the charter schools that aren't open to everybody.
Do you feel like that should change? You know, like, what if I wanted my kid to go to Spring Harbor, but we're in the West attendance area? Can't do it. You know, I'm just saying, there's already that problem.
Yeah, there is. You know, would I change it? Yeah, if I could figure out a way to do it. Taking Spring Harbor and Ryan as an example, you have to look at why they exist. Okay, because that's been lost kind of in the midst of time. They exist to deal with overcrowding. Okay, most people don't know that in today's world. But Wright Middle School was created originally because the West Middle School were overcrowded. Hamilton and Cherokee were overcrowded. And they created one of the times called Madison School in 2000. And it was designed for the purpose of relieving that overcrowding. As opposed to building another big school, they built a school just big enough to overcome the overcrowding. 3 or 4 years later, and we were pretty successful with it. 3 or 4 years later, that same thing happened in the Memorial area. And at the time they opened Spring Harbor, Jefferson was using either 4 or 6 classrooms in Memorial. So we owned the Spring Harbor building, and it had been a business school and it closed. So we opened Spring Harbor. Their original intent was not so much choice as it was overcrowding. As a matter of fact, interesting enough, with Spring Harbor, one of our fears was Spring Harbor. The reason why it has a specialty was because we were afraid nobody would go. Because people really loved both Tokyo and Jefferson. And so we were afraid because we didn't want to assign people there. Because you never try to change assignments if you can possibly help it. But you do that before you close the school, I did. But the whole idea was, oh my God, how will we ever get people to go there? Because we were having trouble getting people to go to Wright. At one time, Wright only had like 100 kids. So we're worried. That's why we gave it the special. It really was never seen as providing parental choice. It was seen as trying to entice people to go there. Now it's changed, obviously, over the years. But my preference would be if we truly have a choice, not I've got two schools here just alike and I'd really go back, and that's a different model. But if I truly have a school that is a dual language immersion, and another school that is built around math and science, and another school that is performing arts and those kind of things, that those choices be available to everybody. I think that's important. That doesn't mean everybody can get in, because you have a limited size. But the limiting factor is size, not width. Or transportation.
I do have another question. But how do you think the pedagogy, or just the approach to learning, and it's didactic, collaborative, just the style of the teaching that's going on, how do you think that style impacts the relationship and the engagement?
I think it does. I think true didactic teaching doesn't lend to relationships, and for a lot of people, doesn't lend itself to engagement either. But what I believe about children learning, which is really what's more important than teaching, you start with how they learn and build something new. I believe that children, differently than traditionally what we did, and this didn't make any difference. When I went to high school, I graduated high school in 1960, and my recollection of the numbers is about 75% of the kids in the country graduated from high school in that time. It didn't make any difference, because there were very good jobs that you didn't have to have a high school education. In my own, there were 48 kids in my junior class and 33 kids in my senior class. So we had 15 kids drop out. Rural Arkansas school district. And they all went to good jobs. I mean, they didn't like to drop out and stand on the street for them. Whirlpool, the appliance manufacturer, opened a huge, big plant. My junior year in high school worked 3 shifts a day. Well, you know, a bunch of kids said, well, why in the world am I going here? Either back to the farm or go to Whirlpool. They went to Whirlpool. So that was okay. Today, the world is very, very different. And it didn't really matter how we taught. I learned with Dick and Jane. As a matter of fact, some others of you in this room probably learned with Dick and Jane. The same percentage of our kids could learn with Dick and Jane today. There wasn't anything wrong with Dick and Jane for the 80% of the kids who learned that one. It still would work for 80% of the kids. Unfortunately, the 20% of the kids who don't learn go to jail. So, in today's world, so we have to have a better way. So I believe very strongly about learning that, first of all, in the way we taught for centuries almost, we believe that kids learn by taking pieces of knowledge and stacking them on top of each other. That learning was, in fact, linear. You know, I give you this fact, and then I add this fact on top of it, and this fact on top of it, and this fact on top of it, and then I give you a test at the end of the week to find out if you got all those facts on it. That was the way we taught. And for a lot of our kids, they can learn that way. The way I believe kids really learn is the way you and I learn. Because I believe kids are just little bitty adults. And their brain works the same way ours does. That's not how we learn things. We learn things, I believe, by taking a whole group of experiences that we have and making sense out of those experiences and creating systems out of those experiences tied to our previous experience. Okay. There's a whole lot of things that I've been exposed to in 65 years. When I see something new, I relate that new thing and the other new things I learned to the things I already know. And that's not a linear process. In the Wisconsin terms, it's a sifting and winnowing process. Okay. That I make sense out of that new knowledge. So that's how I believe kids learn. So if you think about that, that's why you construct your pedagogy. You construct the experiences that kids have to facilitate that habit, which is very, very different than facilitating kids stacking pieces of knowledge on top of each other. So I believe very, very strongly that in education jargon, that's called constructivist teaching. And it's controversial. Don't misunderstand me. There are people who still believe that we ought to teach the other way. Now, we have pretty good evidence everybody's learning the other way, but still, we have people who believe it. So, anyway, I believe that if you do that in the classroom, that you can, in fact, engage kids, provided you're willing to learn about the child and learn what their experiences are.
I actually have two questions. The first one is just recently there's been some publicity and misperceptions, I believe, on New Eastern Middle School and how that school or another charter school is funded in comparison to how Lakeview or an Emerson would be funded through the MMSD. What percent of the operating costs of our charter school does MMSD itself cover?
All of it.
It does cover all of it. There is no different funding for a charter school.
No, and in the allocation of funding is the same. The only place, New Estramundo was done the way it was done, being added specifically to save money. And Alice was picked because at the time it had by far our largest Spanish speaking population. But Alice at the time had our largest Spanish speaking population. As a matter of fact, at the time we did it. It was that system treaty board. But it was the only school we had that had a sufficient mass of Spanish speaking kids in each grade level to even make it work. And so it was embedded there and really first choice given to Alice kids to save costs. The only addition, they're staffed exactly with the same formula. They get the same, everything is exactly the same. If all of the kids are from Alice, the cost would be no different than Alice would have cost us otherwise, except for the additional principal. And I believe from Rick there's an additional secretary. Where there may be a little bit of difference in terms of cost, but it's a little bit more expensive, is all the kids you have who would have gone to some other school. If you have enough of those kids in the school that they generate the need for a teacher that you wouldn't have had to have if they were all from Alice, that's an additional cost.
And so you would have needed that teacher somewhere else, possibly.
Well, no, because they don't all come.
Okay.
Well, it's the same principle as why everybody says, well, if you're losing these kids, why why does the revenue cap account for it? Because it all goes in the same place. I mean, if we could get everybody who leaves the school district, you know, if our enrollment goes down by 100, if we get all them to go from one school, we're home free. Unfortunately, they go one from each class across 50 different buildings. So, but that would be the incremental cost associated with U.S. Mundo. Now, you take U.S. Mundo out of Alice and you place it in a building of its own, okay, now you're in different ballgames. But that's why U.S. Mundo, the board, when the board finally agreed to do U.S. Mundo, that was the...
But essentially, it balances the cost for the most part of educating those children in their in their regular classroom versus in the charter.
There's no additional money.
And then the other question I have is, what kind of commitment does MMS have to the three charter schools that we have in operation right now?
Except two.
Right? U.S. Mundo?
Yeah.
Okay. Those
two. What kind of commitment? I'm not exactly sure what you mean by that, but charters in Wisconsin, and just one correction, charters are with the school district, not the state in Wisconsin. So, charters in Wisconsin are 5 years, and so when you sign the charter, when the board agrees to have a charter school, and they sign the charter contract with the chartering group, that has to be in the case of Wright, that's the school district. Wright does not have a chartering group. It was actually chartered by the board itself. U.S. Mundo has a chartering group with a separate board of directors. That's a 5-year contract. It has to be renewed after 5 years by the board. The contract specifies what the funding will be, specifies how the governance structure will be, specifies what they have to do in terms of testing and accountability and all those kind of things. And after 5 years, the board reviews that and makes a decision about whether or not to renew that charter. So that's really the commitment, is what's spelled out in that charter. And it can be different from school to school. It doesn't have to be all the same. Each charter school can have a different set of criteria.
I guess my question is, would MMSD at any point, do you foresee them saying, we've decided that we're not going to renew charters in general, whether the criteria met or not? Is charter something that we are committed to once, you know, that school is proving itself successful? Or is there a possibility a charter could get non-renewed just because our philosophy changes?
It could, sure. The charter law in Wisconsin is permissive. That means you don't have to have charter schools. You can choose to have charter schools. And there are certain laws that govern if you're going to choose to have them, what governs that. I don't foresee that happening, but the board could decide tomorrow they're not going to have any more charter schools, and when the current two charters are up, they don't have any more. They can also decide charter by charter, because it is totally permissive. It is totally depends on who's sitting on the board at that point in time. You don't believe me? Look at all the precedents overturned by the last Supreme Court.
Thank you.
You're in a unique position now after being in the school district for a fair amount of time and seeing these changes where you brought in magnet schools and charter schools. Because knowing who you are now, you're talking about how you reflect at the end of each day. How do you reflect back on the last 10 years of those schools and their successes, and what are your opinions of where you think they should be?
The only school we have that is truly a specialty school is Spring Harbor. In terms of what it was intended to do, it's obviously successful. It's got a huge waiting list, and everybody wants to go there. So it was pretty successful at relieving the overcrowding. The two charter schools, I think U.S. Mundo has been successful in almost every sense of the word. And I think it's pretty well known that I opposed it because I believe there were some problems with the model. We haven't reached the point where it's going to play out exactly whether I was wrong or not. And I don't more than position. I told you so. But the real issue with UF Tremundo has always been when you're in an immersion program where the learning is in a language other than your own, you can't just come in the fifth grade. Okay, most immersion programs restrict entrance after the first grade. So after the first grade, you can't enroll in the school. UF Tremundo right now, I believe, restricts at the end of the second grade. Our fear was that we could not replenish the Spanish speakers because the vast majority of our Spanish-speaking population are very mobile. And they move around the city a lot. And so after the second grade, when a kid moves out, you can't replace them. And that same thing is true, obviously, of our English-speaking population. The English-speaking population there isn't as mobile. So there was always the fear. And as we calculated it when we were looking at whether to recommend it or not, there was a real question, and I think it still hasn't been answered completely, but there was a real question about whether or not you could still be dual immersion by the fifth grade, that you would in fact have lost the vast majority of your Spanish speakers. Whether or not that plays out, I don't know. But I think the model is very successful. We always believed the dual immersion was successful. And the reason we didn't implement it ourselves was the one that I had just talked about. Wright is a kind of an interesting situation because it is exactly like all of the middle schools. It does not have any special pedagogy or anything else. The original charter was done, it's been renewed once since. The original charter was done because at the time it was focusing on technology, was the plan. It was focusing on technology, and we believed that we needed to get charter status so we didn't have to get certified teachers to teach the technology part of it. It was one of the driving factors. Wright itself is very much a middle school. It's small, at about 240 or 50 children, but it's very much. I don't see any question. I would be surprised if those don't continue as they are. What direction the board will take, who knows? I think a lot of it depends on what happens politically within the community. A school board in Wisconsin, because you have elections every single year, the majority of the school board can turn over in one calendar year in Wisconsin. You can have an issue arise, wouldn't necessarily be about charter, but you can have an issue arise in Wisconsin that gets a lot of people behind it. And you can change the majority of the board and completely change the direction of the school district in one calendar year. April, you elect two, the next April, you elect two more, you got a majority. So, I wouldn't even dream of predicting what would happen. But I do feel like we're overall in a very, very good place. I think, and I haven't said a word about this, it's probably the only speech I've given in 10 years, I didn't. But the real thing about education in Wisconsin is what happened to school finance. I mean, we can talk about all this other stuff all we want to. But the bottom line is, if we don't change school finance in Wisconsin, it ain't gonna matter.
Okay, there were two more, one there, and then we'll call it a day.
I treated a meeting with it from your initial remarks. I kind of got the impression you said that 5% we have to concentrate on, and then 95% they're all the same. And I think what you really need is there are 25% groups that need to be dealt with individually.
No, I don't think you understood. I was talking about the responses that kids make in the survey.
And there's 5% of us that are way outliers?
No. 95% of the answers. Okay. Let's say there's 100 questions. There was 100 questions on the survey. Okay. 95 of the answers, there was no statistical difference in the responses that kids make regardless of race or income. So if one of the questions was, do you like school? They all answered it the same way. 5% of those questions, 5 of those questions, there were statistically significant differences in the way kids responded, either based on race or based on income. That was what I said.
Well, okay, that makes sense, more sense. But I still think there are 20 different groups of 5% of the kids. They asked one teacher to handle 25 kids. each one requiring a different means of communication, different understanding. It's too much. Plus, kids are going to self-segregate. By the time you're in high school, you can call them cliques, or you can call them gangs. They're going to be self-segregating. It almost sounded like you were saying, well, it's either all, give everybody a full choice, or don't give anybody a choice. Is there any kind of meeting place where you say, all right, let's let these kids group together, limited, you don't want everybody abandoning their school to go somewhere else, but also, and then meeting their needs, and just one or the other.
Well, what I'm telling you is my belief about what's best. I mean, that's just my belief. That doesn't mean it's right, wrong, or whatever. It's my belief. Well, I think what you just said is exactly what happens. It is self-selected. There are kids who stay where they are. They may not necessarily want to stay where they are. They have to stay where they are because they don't have the opportunity to go to the other place. That's a problem. To me, one of the major issues that we have to deal with when the purpose of K-12 education is to prepare kids to be successful adults. That's the purpose. Now, right now, our federal government thinks the purpose is to take tests, but they're confused. But the ultimate purpose is to prepare kids to be adults. The world that our kids, right now, first of all, think about the fact that our kindergartners will be in the workforce 60 years from now. We ain't got a clue what it's going to look like. But the one thing I can tell you for sure it's going to look like is it's going to really be diverse. They are going to have to work with both as peers, as superiors and subordinates. They're going to have to work with kids who speak a different language than they do, who look differently than they do, who come from a completely different culture than they do, and their ability to do that, is going to determine their success, regardless of having skill. That's going to be what's going to be the most important thing. Every day, in my view, that we do not create an environment in which they learn how to do it, we are shortchanging that job and decreasing their chances of being successful. To me, it's one of the biggest strengths of the Madison Metropolitan School District, is that we have that diversity. And that diversity isn't just about race. It's about disability. It's about ability to communicate, not just language. It's all of those kinds of things. And anytime we create a public school environment, okay, in which we create situations in which children and parents can self-segregate based on race, based on language, based on intellect, based on any of those kind of things, I believe is not what our country needs. That's my belief. Now, you believe completely differently. That's one of the great things about being American. That's what I believe.
But don't you think
I didn't say it was going to segregate all the way.
You said intellect. That was what you were pretty
No, great. You attached that to white. I didn't. I did not attach
no,
that
I
to white.
No, you said intellect. No, that's what I'm saying. You said they could select it by race or whatever. But there are a lot of disadvantaged people that could be very gifted and talented.
True.
Are they finding those and helping them find their
I group? Think so. I mean, if you look rationally at the data, not the perception, not the emotion, look at the data. This past year, our school district, the Madison Metropolitan School District, has doubled in both low income and children of color in my tenure as superintendent. This past year, the Madison Metropolitan School District scored the highest ACT score in its history. Now, for some people, that might maybe not be a big deal, except ours were already some of the highest in the nation as a district. Okay, so while we have in fact brought our low-income kids up, we have also brought all of our high achievers up. It is not a zero-sum game. And it just isn't, in my view. You know, and it isn't a zero-sum game. You can, in fact, do that. I have an awful lot of faith in our teachers. I think we know how to differentiate across a very broad range of children. Do we have children we can't differentiate? Absolutely. We have, 2 years ago, we had a child, we still have a child in the fifth grade now, started taking calculus at the university in the third grade. Okay? Can we differentiate from him? No! We can't. We don't even attempt to. But that, talk about the outlier, that's the outlier. We probably, and we have those children. You go back and look in history, 8 years ago, 9 years ago, of the United States team that went to the International Science Olympiad, selected from all over the United States of America, there were 6 kids selected, 5 of them from here, this school district. So we have those children. And when you're talking about the child, when you're talking about the child who's truly the intellectual outlier, you can't differentiate. And we don't even attempt to. You know, that's why we bring people in from the university or we take them to the university. Those opportunities are provided. And I think everybody knows those kind of kids.
Can I add on to this question? Yeah. Because it's my belief from talking with various people that those who are getting really high ACT scores are kids who have gotten supplemental education outside of MSD, which again causes haves and have-nots, because the current counseling and gifted program has been liberal based so severely that it's almost non-existent. And children who are of color, who are from poverty backgrounds, and of course talented and giftedness across all groups, they are not getting what they need, and I have seen it. And now my child isn't disadvantaged, and she would fall into some of the people that you're describing several grades up. Has not in 4 years been challenged to the point that she should be. And then I think about people that I went to medical school with who are Black or Hispanic, and they would not. Coming from an elementary school in Madison, I do not believe they're challenged adequately enough to be able to get into medical school nowadays. If they were to go through Madison.
The only way I can respond, I certainly don't blame the debate about. I believe you're wrong. I don't intend to debate whether you got it wrong. I believe you're wrong. I believe there's absolutely no data. Now, remember that we're not talking about a small group of kids scoring high on the ACT. We're talking about over 70% of our kids taking the test. They didn't all have supplemental services. As a matter of fact, we've heard the rumor many, many times. The only reason why the test scores are high was because the kids were all homeschooled and then they came and took the test.
Well, no, that isn't true. Black or Hispanic, is what I'm asking.
Right now, we have a program in all of our middle schools, Project Excel, that is designed specifically to identify our children of color, our children from low-income backgrounds, and support them in trying to get to that. You get those children there starting back down in kindergarten. You don't get them there in the ninth grade. But again, you know, in my mind, there are all kinds of early myths. The truth is, we've never been able to pinpoint a single piece of data that says, in fact, that all of our kids who score high, as a matter of fact, even a minuscule part of our kids who score high, had, in fact, supplemental services.
But has it been looked at? Okay. Sure. I promise one more question. That conversation can continue later. One more.
Yeah, I think this could kind of be a wrap-up kind of a question, perhaps. It goes back to where you started. We started the day about a couple of things, talking about Yvonne, and which to me is, okay, I mean, it's the structure that can be very unified or it can be very differentiated across different buildings. We also talked a lot about relationships, and that was one of the things you focused on, was how important those building-level relationships are so that you can have that East math team work together and spend the time doing it, and that you can have an elementary school that identifies a certain success and is able to build on that. And I think a lot of the educational research talks about principal leadership and the ability to build a teacher professional community as a real support for that kind of building level relationship. And so my perception in Madison is that we're sort of, and I'm sure it's a pendulum, that we're on a trend toward less differentiation across our schools. That there's been an attempt to kind of pull in the curriculum to create more standardized curriculum. We're in the process of a high school redesign that I think is looking at trying to create more consistency for some very good reasons. But I think what I'm trying to get at is there are trade-offs between that consistency across schools and the ability to create relationships and uniqueness and creativity within buildings. So I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about where you see Madison going as far as being, you know, traditionally these little sort of fiefdoms with principals at the head to being a more,
I don't agree with your premise, and that is that consistency, in fact, increases your ability to differentiate. Probably increases your ability to differentiate. Actually, differentiation occurs because I have the strategies and the skills and the knowledge to, in fact, reach a broad group of kids. It doesn't have to mean that can be consistent or not consistent. That really doesn't have to do with consistency. What I think you try to achieve in our elementary schools right now are consistent. But each one of them has certain kinds of things that are unique to their population. And so what you try to achieve is a fundamental consistency. And we're talking about consistencies in the way you do things, not necessarily. But let me give you an example. If you go back and look at when I came here in 94, literally, every teacher taught a reading program that they wanted to. I mean, didn't have anything to do with England. I mean, just whatever. And the one I can remember the best is I was called in as the deputy and I had to go over and kind of negotiate an agreement between eight parents who had twins. And they're in different second grade classes. And they're having two reading programs. They were as far apart as you could get. One teacher, honest to God, was using a 1976 Basel reader. This is 1994. Okay. I mean, these are old tattered books that she brings out every time. The other teacher is using the most extreme form of whole language. And this parent was asking the most obvious question, which is, what happens to him next year? And think about some poor third grade teacher who's going to get those two kids. So that's literally where we were. Everybody did exactly what they wanted to. Two problems with that. One is what I just mentioned with the third grade teacher, or even worse, moving from one school to the other. And the other thing is, how do you ever teach anybody to do it? I mean, you've got to have some consistency. So right now, while we have a consistent reading program across the school district, the way that reading program, and the reading program itself is a series of frameworks that's very flexible for the teacher to use based on where the children are in the class. So the teacher, what we're trying to do is build a consistent but continually broadening set of tools that a teacher has to work with kids and then help them learn how to recognize where that child is and apply the right tools. That's what we're trying to do. That requires teacher education, which is the professional learning communities, those kind of things that you're talking about. Well, you can't have that if you don't have a consistent language and a consistent set of things that people are trying to learn. I can't teach 400 different programs. So that's one of the reasons for consistency, as well as the fact that when you have a mobile population, And our population right now is not as mobile as it was at one time because nobody can sell their pass. But our population in Madison has been relatively mobile, not just in our low income population, but around the city. So if that's the situation that you have, you at least want, if the child is going to transfer within the school district, that they at least recognize that they're in the school district. And so that's why you see us with a consistent approach, for example, to behavior and some of those kind of things. I don't think it at all negates differentiation. It's just differentiation occurs because the teacher has a broad range of tools that they can apply in the right situation for the right kid. So the premise, I believe, is not correct. But where are we in that process? I think we're we do a good job in the elementary school. And I did the same thing I said about everything else. I think we've made a lot of progress in the elementary school. I feel pretty good about it. Middle schools, we're about halfway. High schools, we're just beginning. The high school redesign is a difficult situation because we tried high school, whatever we called it. We called it high school reform. We called it high school renewal. I mean, you know, we had a name for it. We actually started trying to do that in the mid-60s. And there's been movement after movement after movement after movement to try to do that. None of them successful. Because they all have gotten at the organizational structure. The Follett form block was part of the high school reform movement. We've tried to get it to schedule, flexible lodgement scheduling. I don't know if any of you went to school under that fun deal. That was fun. But anyway, all of those were attempts to change the high schools. But they all went after the structure. Well, the high school reform that needs to happen is in the classroom. It doesn't matter what the schedule is. I mean, you can figure out what you want to do in the classroom and have a schedule that enhances it, but we never in the high school have gone after the classroom. And some of it is just the mentality of teachers and what level they fit. Elementary teachers become elementary teachers because they want to teach kids. Now again, this is a generality. I'm sure there's some that become some other ones, but generally speaking, high school teachers become high school teachers, and I was one of these, don't misunderstand. High school teachers become high school teachers because they want to teach the subject. I became a biology teacher because I loved biology. And I wanted to impart biology. There were some kids there too, but I wanted to impart biology. Now in my case, I wanted to impart zoology. I didn't like plants and still don't. So I have there's thousands of kids that had biology under me out there right now who probably don't know anything in the world about photosynthesis. That was wrong. But anyway, so you're dealing with just the fundamental reason why somebody's in the profession, I think, and which is one of the reasons why I think it takes long to get to the high school. But like I said, if you've been in as long as I have, you see the same things come up again. They just call it something different. You know, I've seen the same reform movements come through four or five different times with a little bit different name. But they all get at, all of those have got organizational structure.
Okay.
Great. Thank you all.
Thank you. Thank you.
Don't forget to fill out your feedback form.